I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. All right, before we get to our agenda, just a few housekeeping items for today's hearing. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There is an overflow room in room 316. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. Clapping and disruptions are not allowed. Additionally, all the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to those limits. We have a lot of bills on our agenda today and want to make sure we have time for member discussion as well. And then thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping to maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. We do have 7 bills on the agenda. Also, we have letters that have been submitted as testimony, and they're in the member packets, they're online, and they're out front for those who are present. I will just say it is my pleasure to be back here co-chairing. A member that shall not be named approached Chair Novotny and I in the retiring room and almost called us Mr. and Mrs. Chair. So please don't do that. Again, we will not name that member. But it's my honor to co-chair with you, Chair Novotny. So with that, the first order of business is approval of the last meeting's minutes. Representative Tabke, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 13, 2025?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Tabke moves approval of the minutes for March 13, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 13, 2025 are approved. Members, before we get to our agenda, we do have an updated committee rules that's in your committee packets and posted online. Those rules reflect an agreement between Chair Novotny and I as part of the co-sharing agreement. There are no substantive changes. And then please pay attention to committee hearing notices and postings to know who to contact regarding testimony and amendments. I guess when in doubt, just email everybody. All right, and now we have before us House File 1998. It is a Representative Rarick bill. Welcome back to the committee, Chair Rarick. And since you're not a member of the committee, I will move to recommend that House File 1998 be placed on the general register. I do see that you have an author's amendment. Would you like us to adopt the A2 amendment, and do you have anything to say about it before we do?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, if you would adopt it, and then we'll speak to the amendment, or to the bill as a whole.
Great. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. And please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this is an OJP policy bill, which is why I have OGP, and I also have the state's office here with me as they've been collaborating on this bill. And Madam Chair and members, this bill extends victim notice and it changes some requirements. And I'm going to be very, very brief because you have a very long agenda. But it adds in OFP, HRO, no contact orders, and harassment restraining orders in the victim notice and makes some simple changes that are really good for victims. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, thank you. And do I see Suzanne Elwell, would you like to go first?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs. The proposal before you offers some refinements to existing crime victim notification requirements. It expands the types of crimes where a prosecutor must notify a victim when they decide to decline to file charges. Under this proposal, the list would now include violations of an OFP, order for protection, violations of a harassment restraining order, and violations of a domestic abuse no contact order. It also shifts responsibility for providing a juvenile court notice to victims from the courts to prosecutors, and it provides that the notice should be given at the start of the case rather than to just victims who attend a court proceeding. Prosecutors are best suited to give this notice as they have victim contact information and are already communicating with victims and providing notifications to them. The proposal also provides clarification to the provisions related to the law enforcement victim notifications, often referred to as the victim information card given by law enforcement to victims. The clarifications are needed to correct some inaccuracies, update some terminology, use plain language, and make clear that the notice can be provided by law enforcement electronically. And then finally, it makes clear that the additional information required to be given to homicide victims is a separate notice beyond the victim information card and is not and should not be included on that card. And with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
All right, thanks. We'll finish the testimony first and then go to member questions. Nicole Freeman, please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Nicole Freeman. I'm from the Office of the Secretary of State, their Government Relations Director there. And I'm here in support of House File 1998. And want to thank Representative Rarick, the OJP, as well as the Department of Corrections for their collaboration in this bill and for the author's amendment. In the author's amendment, the language was added to alert victims to the Safe at Home program or our state's IDRS confidentiality program. As you might know, our office operates that program, and it is a program that protects the physical location of individuals who fear for their physical safety. And it's a program that's widely used by victims of abuse as well as individuals who have significant safety concerns due to their profession. And so although we've always done outreach and will continue to do so, we commonly hear from survivors and victims that they wish they would have known about the program sooner. And so no one might have told them that the program existed. And so this would really help inform people sooner of their availability of the program and potentially help keep our communities and individuals safer. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a great addition to the bill, and it's a really important program, the Safe at Home program. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, but are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing anybody, so we will move on to member discussion. Any member discussion? Chair Novotny.
Chair Mueller, this is, I'd like to thank Representative Rarick for working on this and everyone else to put the time in this, clean up some of the language, get it updated. Been in consultation with her, and I think it's a good rework and a good update. So thank you for bringing it forward. I recommend the yes.
All right. Any closing comments, Chair Rarick?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a really important bill for victims, and I really appreciate working again with two amazing people. And Ms. Elwell and I worked together on the working group when we changed quite a bit of statute around criminal sexual conduct. So it's good to be at the table again with her. So it's an amazing bill. OJP has worked really hard on it and really listened to victims, and I ask you to support it.
All right, with that, I renew the motion to recommend that House File 1998, as amended, be placed on the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, thank you. Thanks to the testifiers. And Chair Rarick, you can just stay there because I'm going to join you at the testifiers' table, and Vice Chair Feist will take over. The next bill on today's agenda is House File 1082, Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move that House File 1082 be re-referred to Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee? That is my motion. Thank you. I see you have someone beside you to co-present the bill. This is in my script, so apparently we need to announce
I'll let you
this
know
officially.
When it's
okay, fabulous. Great, your bill is before us. I see that you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you are presenting today?
That's my motion.
Great, and we do have an A1 amendment to the DE2 amendment. Chair Novotny, I believe this is yours. Okay, so we will disregard the amendment to the DE2. And so back to the DE, or did we just move the DE2? Or is there any discussion to the DE2 amendment? Seeing no discussion, Chair Mueller moves that the DE2 amendment moves the DE2 amendment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The DE2 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So this is the Crime Victim Services funding bill. We have been funding crime victim services at the state level, but a lot of their money comes from federal dollars and a lot of it flows through the state. It's been really unstable in recent years, that federal funding, really, really unstable. And in 2023, we were under the impression that maybe that federal funding would ramp up again. We did fill in some gaps with state funding, and it just doesn't look like that is going to stabilize anytime soon, and they're facing additional pressures as well. So we really are at a crisis moment right now with victim services funding. Victim services funding is really important for domestic violence advocates and domestic violence shelters, sexual assault advocates, general crime advocates, child abuse centers, really any type of crime that impacts a person have access to victim services. There's a 24-hour hotline. It's just really crucial, not only to the victims and survivors who get served, but to public safety in Minnesota. And so one of the things that we are looking at, understanding really what the budget situation is like this year, is trying to create an alternative special revenue account that is going to be dedicated to victim services funding that different sources of revenue can be placed under. And so the DE amendment that we just adopted creates that account. I think it is a starting place, and we are certainly open for more suggestions of what kinds of revenue could be placed in that account. And I would like to turn it over to Chair Rarick, who we've been working together on this and other issues for years. We did not plan to color coordinate today, but it just happened. And so I'd like to turn it over to her as well to make some comments.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Yeah. Just a happy situation here. We both wore the same color. So we have been working on this for quite some time, and if you could have heard our conversation in the retiring room, you would have been laughing your just head off, because we were trying to come up with different revenue sources so that we have more stability. And really, that's what this is. It's a bill trying to create some stability for victims who are in their absolute lowest moment of their lives. They have been, you know, that if a victim of domestic violence leaves, that's the most dangerous time for her. The only other time that's slightly more dangerous is when she's pregnant, unfortunately. So this is kind of a last-ditch effort to try to save some of this money, because we don't know what's happening at the federal level. It's been up and down all over the place. So we're really, this is sort of an effort of the whole, both sides of the aisle, trying to come together to actually come up with some ideas of how we can take care of the most vulnerable in our communities and our society.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Chair Rarick. I believe you have a couple of testifiers who are here today. And the first testifier on my list is Sarah Reynolds. And please state your name and your title for the record, and then you can begin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Reynolds, and I am the Executive Director of Child's Place, a children's advocacy center located in Redwood Falls. We serve six counties in southwest Minnesota, as well as the Lower Sioux Indian community. Our dedicated team consists of just three individuals, one forensic interviewer, one child advocate, and myself. Last year alone, Child's Place provided services to 109 children. Children's advocacy centers play a vital role in supporting victims by uniting teams of professionals to respond quickly and effectively to child abuse. Through forensic interviews conducted by trained experts, we ensure that children's voices are heard clearly and respectfully using proven techniques that help them share their experiences in a safe and neutral location. This process not only protects the child, but also provides crucial testimony for investigations, bringing justice and healing while prioritizing their well-being. Whether it's offering comfort in a courtroom while a child testifies, assisting grandparents in creating a safe place for children placed in their care, or helping a child obtain medical services after being branded by their abuser, we stand by children and families during their most traumatic moments. Our services empower children, offering them a lifeline of dignity, security, and hope. A staggering 85% of our budget relies on grants from the Office of Justice Programs through state and federal funds. Any reduction in this funding would force us to close our doors, halting services to children in our rural communities. Crime victim service agencies are stuck in the uncertainty of not knowing how long they'll be able to continue to operate. This uncertainty overflows onto our partners in law enforcement and child protection. The loss of our services has a detrimental impact on the way the teams respond to child abuse. However, the most heartbreaking part of this uncertainty is when caregivers ask me, will you be with us when we go to court next year? And I have to say, I don't know. The thought of these children and families navigating the court system alone is unbearable. As someone deeply committed to supporting victims of crime, I urge you to recognize the critical need for continued funding for crime victim service programs. By supporting these programs, you are not only investing in the well-being of our children, but you are assuring the safety of our communities. Please support House File 1082. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you so much. Our next testifier who is on the list is Tammy McConkie. And Tammy, when you come up, please state your name and your title for the record, and then you can begin.
Hello, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Tammy McConkie. I'm an attorney, and I work in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. One of the things that I do there is that I'm the director of our Crime Victim Services Program. And so we are a program of 13 victim witness advocates who are working alongside the prosecutors. And our main goal of our advocates is to make sure that the victim's rights are realized, that they get under Minnesota Statute 611A. Currently, the Office of Justice Programs funds two of our advocate positions, and right now, each of our advocates is carrying a caseload of about 230 cases. And that, to put it in context, an ideal number would be about 100 to 150, and we've been at 230 for some time. Just in the last quarter of 2024, our advocates served over 2,000 crime victims. We gave notice of hearings over 10,000 times during that time period, and we gave information about the criminal justice process, victims' rights, answered their questions about 5,000 times during that process. These are the things that we do because we're required under the statute. But there are other things that we should do to help make the process more bearable and less painful for victims, like we would really like to accompany victims to court hearings when they go to court. We would like to be able to find wheelchairs for them, to find places for them to park or help them get rides to court. And if we were to lose funding, these are things that we may not be able to continue to do. We also try to take a very holistic approach to serving victims because we understand that this is what helps them to heal from what happened to them and to also help them regain their strength to return to being participating and cooperative members of our community. So in order to take that holistic approach, we really need to work alongside community-based advocates like domestic violence advocates, sexual assault advocates, because their work starts before our prosecution and often runs long after it. And so working together, that gives victims the best of both worlds. Our advocates reach out to community-based advocates to do things like help domestic violence victims find a new place to live if they need to. It helps them find shelter if they need it, food resources, support groups, crisis intervention, civil attorneys that will help them with different matters, and all variety of different resources. So, if they were to lose funding, the ability that the both types of agencies would have to provide the best possible experience for victims who are going through a terrible time, going through the court system, would be really impacted. So I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have two members of the public who signed up to testify on House File 1082. And the first person is Andrew Morris. And on deck is Sally Meany. And Sally, once Andrew's finished, you can head right up. Andrew, please state your name and your title for the record, and you can begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Morris, and I serve as the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I'm here today to express the Council's support for House File 1082, offered by Chair Mueller. Specifically, preventing and addressing gender-based domestic and sexual violence has been a long-standing priority for the council. As part of its work to address this issue, the council has long encouraged the state to support a holistic approach through various state agencies to address and ideally prevent these crimes from occurring. This history included spearheading a pilot program to prevent sexual domestic violence and sexual assault prevention that was administered by the Minnesota Department of Health. Since the conclusion of that program in 2022, the council has continued to work with stakeholders, including the Office of Justice Programs, to continue this work. The council has supported this initiative from the Office of Justice Programs in the past and is proud to do so again today. We are particularly encouraged that this legislation, in addition to providing crucial further resources, prioritizes programs that serve culturally specific and other underserved communities, which are critical to effectively reaching survivors for whom traditional outreach may not be accessible. We strongly encourage the committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Sally Meany. And you can introduce yourself when you get up there and get going.
Hi, I'm Sally Meany. I'm a lifelong Minnesota resident. If this committee is looking for funds to support victim services, I have found the funds. It is sitting in prison. 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislation passed the Humane MRRA law. Thank you for your successful efforts to make Minnesota safer while relocating taxpayers' funds. Inmates that actively pursue rehabilitation and modeled rape behavior gain the right to a 17% reduction of days of incarceration. At $176 per diem, one qualified inmate released is a yearly savings of $64,000. Out of 10,000 inmates, there are surely 1,000 who qualify right now, which equals $64 million. Out of 50% of this money goes to the Office of Justice Programs, which includes victim services. So where is your $32 million? The Department of Corrections was given 18 months, January 1, 2025, to implement pilot programs and policy decisions. Now they have pushed the date out further to September 2025. This will result in $0 for promised programs in fiscal year 2026. Perhaps the new Committee on Fraud, Waste, and Abuse should review this situation. No more delays. Fund these great programs now. Thank you for your time. And I have there's a handout that goes with this about more details about how this program is supposed to be funding all of these other programs. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And now we will turn to member discussion. Any members have comments? Yes, Representative Hudson. Sorry, I was like, are you raising your hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Boy, did I pick the wrong seat to be able to actually be able to turn and look at you guys. So I have a couple of concerns about this bill. So specifically in lines 117 through 120 of the DE2, which is what I believe we're on, right? Hard to keep track. So services funded must, got that word must, include services for victims of crime in underserved communities most impacted by violence and reflect the ethical, racial, economic, cultural, and geographic diversity of the state. That's one part. And then the second part of up to 10% of the appropriation is available for grant administration. So in terms of how these funds would end up being distributed statewide, how are we perceiving that there might be geographic disparities as a result of this language? And either of you can take it, but I imagine Representative Mohler would want to jump at it.
Chair Mohler. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. So this is the exact same language that we had in the bill last year as well. If someone's from OJP is here and wants to speak to how they actually make these determinations, but this is the same language that we have used in past years. And I will say that as we discussed this last year, we talked about the diversity and that some communities do impact crimes more than others, but we did include in here geographic diversity as well because we want to make sure that victims in every corner of the state are getting the services that they need and that they deserve, quite frankly. So if you have a specific question about how it's actually allocated or decided, I'm happy to see if OJP is here or one of the coalitions could maybe answer that question. Or I don't know if Chair Rarick has thoughts on it.
Chair Rarick?
Thank you. I was actually going to ask some of the fiscal staff if they have some of that. And we do have OJP that's still in the room, too, if they want to talk about how they allocated across the state.
Great. Ms. Babine, you can introduce yourself and then answer the question. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Kim Babine, I'm Interim Executive Director at the Office of Justice Programs. Madam Chair, Representative, to your question about how this is implemented, the request for proposals that we put out, that is our competitive funding process for these funds, asks the people who are applying for information around where they serve, what communities they serve, and what the community makeup is, and how they are reaching those communities. When we talk about those communities most impacted by violence, we're looking at crime data around the state as to where there are there's more violence that may need to be addressed. But one of the, as Chair Mohler said, don't lose that geographic diversity because that is a very high priority for the Office of Justice Programs. It's one of the primary things that we look at because we want to make sure that people in all areas of the state have access. And it's one of the real issues with cuts to the program because you can imagine that if people have to drive far to receive services, that's obviously a detriment. The testifiers' comments around the child advocacy centers, I think about them a lot in terms of how far a child might have to go to receive services. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hudson, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have any data regarding like how that actually breaks down dollar-wise in terms of where the money is going, like perhaps a percentage that is directed to the metro versus outstate?
Yep. I don't have that information in terms of percentage and also depends on exactly how you look at the metro, of course, but we do have that information, and I believe it's on our website. If it's not, we can, we'll share it with you one way or another. But we do. In the past, we've created maps so that you can see exactly where that distribution is.
And Ms. Babine, we can share that with the committee afterwards too. Thank you, Representative Mohler.
Yeah, thank you. And I just wanted to add to that as well. Not every community is going to have a child abuse center. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many there are in the state, but not every county has one of those. So one county may have it there, but it may serve a larger population of surrounding counties. Or like there's one program where the 24-hour hotline is at. It's mm-hmm. located in Hennepin County, but of course Minnesota victims from all over the state can use that hotline. So sometimes it's not exactly an apple-to-apple Absolutely. Comparison.
Yep.
Thank you. One more question?
Just one more question. Since I've got you here, it's a great opportunity. So we've got that 10% of the appropriation being used for administrative costs. I had a similar question in Ed Finance that I asked of MDE and wasn't able to get a terribly clear answer. If you don't have to use all of that 10%, what is done with the balance? Does it go towards more grants, or does it come back to us, or how does that work?
Yes, absolutely.
Ms. Babine?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's exactly the case. Or we try to use the least amount possible to ensure good oversight of the grants. We want to make sure that they're administered well, that we are doing all the checks that we need to do. But we want the most money to go to the grants. We don't want it to go to the state, to state staff. We want it to go out to the grants. And so we generally reserve up to 10%, depending on what the option is, up to 2% in some cases. We reserve that, put out the grants, and then depending, in this particular case, we do some work with the, because we have both federal and state funds, we're able to shift some funding so that then we can make sure that all that state funding gets used. So it does go back out in grants the way that we're able to move the funding around. And that's one of the pieces with the special revenue fund account, that if we had the flexibility for that money that was reserved in the for administration costs in the special revenue fund, then it would more easily go out in grants and it wouldn't take such a manual process to make sure those dollars get out.
Thank you. Representative Greenman, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate both of your leadership on this. And I know that in last biennium, we showed a real commitment to this work. I'm wondering if you, either one of you or both of you, have a sense, an estimate of the size of the need, to Representative Hudson's point. Like, if we, what is the size of the need if we could support the organizations and the shelters and the services that folks across the state need in Denver community? What would that look like? Do you have a sense of that?
Chair Mueller?
Thank you. I wish Ms. Babine was still up here because I know they can tell you how many at least applied last time, and I think that is a good place to start talking about what the need might look like.
Right. And Ms. Babine, you can stay because I understand there are some more questions for you too from other members, so if you'd like to answer.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the amount of the need, that is a great question, and we, just like Chair Mueller was saying, we are using the amount that was requested in the last competitive process as our starting point. So in the last competitive process, we were putting out funds for one-year grants. We ended up amending them and adding more funds to them later, but we put out, we had $62 million available in funding, and we had $100 million in requests. And so that $100 million, I think it was $101 million in requests. A couple of things to keep in mind. That was in 2023, and so costs have obviously risen since then. The need, the coalitions can speak to the need as well, and the increases there. The other piece is, we know that not all the people in the state doing the work applied. We had limited ability to really get the word out about, hey, here's this competitive funding process. And so that's something that OJP is really committed to make sure that we are identifying organizations across the state who are doing this work so that they know that the funding opportunity is available. So I would say $100 million a year is a starting point, but it's not reflective of the entire need.
Representative Greenman?
Thank you. And so I hear you saying that's probably a floor, just as we're thinking about it. And do you have a sense, and I know everything's in flux, including the appropriations that we did in the last biennium or one time, and so I appreciate the idea of that both of you, and I think I heard sort of finding a long-term and sustainable funding source, because obviously this need is not year to year. Do you have a sense of if we lose the federal funding, how much of a hole that will be in that $100 million?
Yes, Babine.
And I have that right here. So the hole left if we don't receive the federal funding. Yes, so we receive, apparently I'm going to do this from memory. Okay, so we receive, there's about $30 million a year in state funding that we receive. The federal funding that's stable, that we generally receive year to year, and again, I'm rounding from memory here. So the stable funding that we receive year to year is from three different pots, and that equals about $6 million a year. The unstable funding source that the Chair Mueller was referring to is the Federal Victims of Crime Act funds. And that's where we received about $12.5 million last year. In the past, that's been high as $50 million. And that is where this crisis is. So if we do not have those funds, we will absolutely have to make cuts for the grants that start 10/1/25. If we are able to get those federal funds in, then there is a chance that we can it will probably still be a slight cut or about stable funding for the next grant year, but it would be only one more year of close to steady funding.
Ms. Bavine, I didn't quite catch for the stable funding. Did you say $6 million or $60 million? It's very different, so I feel like I should know.
And I rounded incorrectly, so it's a little higher than that. But there's 1.5 in VAWA, 1.8 in SAS, Sexual Assault Services Program, and 4.5 in Family Violence Prevention and Services Act funding. Great.
Thank you so much. Representative Greenman, did you have any follow-up? No?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you. I think in lots of our committee areas, we're talking about how do we continue to fund and find stable funding for the services and the supports that our communities need. This is an important one. We obviously, as a state, are not going to be able to make up the full whole of the federal government, and it sounds like we're making up some of the instability, even if that federal funding continues. So I really appreciate your work, and I'm proud to support this bill.
Thanks. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this bill. I do support it. I have a question, though. Just need some clarity on something. So I believe you cited the special revenue account, Miss. I'm sorry, what's your name?
Bavine.
So in 2018, I do believe that there was an increase on the federal funding side through the Trump administration. And then in 2020, through the Biden administration, there were some funding cuts to VOCA. And you had cited earlier to Representative Hudson's question of the O&M costs, that up to 10%, that kind of fluctuates based off of the funding that is appropriated on the federal side of things and how that might either necessitate you guys to take more funding on the O&M costs or reduce those costs. Could you touch on that a little bit more? Is that something that you guys do often if there's an increase or a decrease in those cuts federally, regardless of the administration, on how that impacts the O&M from the OJP side of things?
Ms. Bavine?
Madam Chair, Representative, forgive me if I'm wrong. The O&M, what does that mean?
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The oversight and management costs.
Thank you.
Ms. Bavine?
Operations and maintenance. Thank you. I just haven't called it that, so thank you. So you're asking, depending on the ups and downs in the federal funding, how much state admin do we take out of the state? I don't have an exact answer for that, but the amount of admin costs that we would take on the state funds would be relative to the state funds. We wouldn't use state funds to administer the federal funds. We do get a portion of those federal awards that we're able to use for administration. So we wouldn't use state funds to subsidize the work that needs to be done from the federal awards, if that makes sense. I guess I might not be understanding you. So if the federal awards go up and down, then we take the grant administration costs based on that amount.
Representative Engen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if there's more coming in from the federal side, would that allow you guys to take less on the state side for the O&M costs or of that 10% that you guys are eligible to retain for grant administration?
Ms. Bavine?
Madam Chair, Representative, again, we don't necessarily, we don't want one to subsidize the other. We want the state operation, did you say operations and maintenance?
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Okay, thank you. those funds to be used for, to work on the, for staff to work on the state grants and the federal funds to be supporting that. So perhaps there's a chance that it might decrease the need for those state grant dollars, but I would say there's not a clear correlation because we correlate it to the funding source.
Representative Ingen, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we can talk offline too. I just wanted to understand that a little bit more clearly, but thank you for the information.
Thanks. And Co-Chair Novotny?
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. And I forget your title. What's your title there?
I'm Interim Executive Director, Madam Chair.
Executive Director Bavine. So we don't have the money coming in from MRRA.
Chair Novotny, do you mind putting the mic just a little
bit? We don't have the money coming in from MRRA that we were planning on. And how are we making up that funding? How much were we planning on getting? And how are we making that up as far as funding these programs?
It looks like Chair Mueller has input.
Yep, thank you. So the MRRA funding, we didn't have, there was no fiscal note with that bill in past years. So, and it's not, you know, I think another testifier mentioned this as well. They are in a pilot right now and it will be rolled out, but it hasn't been implemented yet. And so there is no money, so to speak, in a pot, and there's no projection of money. I mean, ultimately what our goal would be is to put those savings into the special revenue account as well. But at this point, we don't have an estimate from that. And I don't know if fiscal staff wants to add more, but we didn't, there was no number that was associated with that in past years.
Mr. Walls or Diebel? Mr. Walls?
Madam Chair, members, as of yet, the department has never fiscal noted because they did not know. They just said that they couldn't anticipate how many people would be given early release until the program was up and running and had some experience.
Chair Novotny?
Another question for the interim executive director. Ms. Bavine, you talked about how you take into consideration the pre-existing language from the past bill. It's going to be the same as that's in this bill, talking about underserved communities impacted by violence reflecting ethnic, racial, economic, cultural, and geographic diversity in the state. How much of the grant process takes that sentence into the amount of grants that are given?
Ms. Bavine?
Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, you asked the amount of the grant process that takes that, or the grants that are put out. Is that what you said?
Novotny.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Oh, the effort.
Oh, how much weight is put on that sentence in one of the grant requests based on what they request as opposed to what you actually award in a grant?
Ms. Bebe?
Madam Chair, Chair Novotny, that is a great question. As I reflect on our last RFP, that information, particularly around the ethnic, racial, economic, cultural diversity of the state, is a question that's asked on the application in terms of who are the individuals or victims in your area that you are looking to serve, and what is your ability and what is your ability to serve them and what do you bring to those services? So I don't have a exact percentage, but that is one of many questions about the work that an organization is doing, the type of work, the type of services, and how they accomplish those services.
Chair Novotny?
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Well, I asked that because in looking at the way that the funds are distributed in the current grant program, when we're doing some dieting, and I have to say it's pretty hard to look at the OJP grant site and really get a focus on how much money is going to which areas for what services. It's pretty convoluted. I can see where some of the information on the grantees are not even in the right counties, and you can't tell some of these organizations that are providing these vital services that I also absolutely support, and they might be covering multiple counties, but it's if you look on your website, it'll just say one county. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. I looked at my area that is served by a group called Rivers of Hope. Rivers of Hope is actually based in Monticello, and it covers Sherburn and Wright County. If you look on the OJP website, the grant puts it against Sherburn County, and then the grant, if you work it out, if you combine the populations of Sherburn and Wright County, it ends up being about a buck and a half a person for the population. On the other end of the spectrum, you can look at the Prairie Island community, which receives approximately $437 per person. So I'll contrast that. The rest of Goodhue County, which would also, you know, cover parts of the Prairie Island community, gets approximately $21 per person. So I'm really confused, or I'm obviously the geographic diversity plays a really big deal. You must put a lot of weight into that to have these great disparities. For those of us that worked in criminal justice system, we have the lawyers on the other side, we have the law enforcement personnel on this side. We all have concerns. It's one of the major calls that we go on. It's one of the most volatile calls that we go on in the last 2 years. We've lost four law enforcement officers on domestic calls as it is. But it's not a call that any of us were still working would shy away from. We run to that call. We just want to make sure that a victim in Southwest Minnesota gets the same service that someone in a different part of the state gets. I feel personally that a domestic abuse victim is equal. There are obviously some areas of the state where their crime overall might take a little bit of consideration into how many services are needed, but in all the times that I, at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm dealing with a domestic abuse victim, and I called my Rivers of Hope people because I knew that we needed to get that victim in touch with an advocate, not once did they ever ask, you know, where are you from, other than how are you going to contact them. They need to get these services. I was shocked when I ran these numbers and looked at the website at the disparities in funding. I don't know how we address that. I'll address that in closing on some of the things we'd like to do. But I'd really like to know, and if you have it, what your formula was that you used to come up with these great disparities in fundings based on different areas, based on this one sentence of the bill when you get a chance.
Didn't sound like there was an immediate question there, but a request. So, is there any other member discussion? Did you have more? You said something about in closing. Did you have more that you wanted? Yeah, what was it?
Well, in that case, I've been working with Chair Moeller on this, and I hope we continue to move this bill forward. Given the time constraints that we are under, there had been discussion, do we hold this bill here in this committee until some of these issues are addressed, or do we move it to judiciary? Chair Moeller, speaking with the staff up here, we don't have a fiscal note yet, and it'll go to, if we go to judiciary, because we are running up against the dates, can we have this come back to this committee and we can discuss this more? Because I'd really like to know how we're going to address this. I really appreciate the funding sources that you have identified as possible ways of getting at coming up with a solid, reliable funding source. But those are down the road. We need to come up with a way of funding this in the meantime. So the money's got to be there. The cuts have come. looking at some of the research since 2018 when we were at peak funding, we're well under half of that now. And looking at the governor's proposal, the governor's budget cuts us by at least half, about half. So we have to figure out something that's sustainable and equitable. Thank you.
And Chair Mueller, did you want to respond to the question about the procedural path for this bill?
I can do my closing at the same time as I respond, if that works. All right. So this will have to go to judiciary because of the marriage license fees that we put on with the DE. But this will absolutely be coming back because this is the Committee of Jurisdiction. I'm happy to work with you. Like you said, we've been having these discussions, and I think we need to dig into the data a little bit more, and I'm glad to do that work together. Also, I just want to make sure people have seen the packets, and I think all the letters are compelling, but I think it's really amazing when you look especially at the letter from the victim coalitions and all of the signatures that are on here, from law enforcement to probation to social workers to healthcare to pastors to other nonprofits from all over the state. So I think there is a general recognition among the community, among the state, and among members of this committee, and certainly in a bipartisan fashion as well, that these victim services are crucial to public safety. And so I look forward to further discussion and hope you can vote yes now to keep the bill moving.
Okay, thank you. And Chair Rarick, did you have anything else that you wanted to conclude with?
I'm here just again to visually show you that this is a bipartisan issue. We work together. I know I've had multiple conversations with Chair Novotny and on multiple bills, actually. I just can't leave this committee. So I'm very happy to work with that, too, and make sure that it is what it needs to be to make sure we have equity across the whole state. I'm very committed to equity across the state. And in fairness, Monticello is my backyard. So that's where Rivers of Hope is. And they should get the funding that they need so they can serve our constituents. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you both for being such champions for crime victim services. With that, Chair Mueller renews the motion that House File 1082, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. And next we have House File 1042. So the next bill on today's agenda is House File 1042, also Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move that House File 1042 be referred to the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. So your bill is before us. You have a DE1 amendment. Would you like to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to present it in?
Yes, that is my motion.
Great. Is there any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none. Chair Mueller moves the DE1 amendment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The DE1 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this bill builds on a bill that we had a few years ago that was enacted into law. And the issue that we encountered actually was a constituent of mine who was a member of the National Guard. And she was victimized by another member of the National Guard and really didn't really go anywhere when she reported it. And we discovered that there were other similar victims and really wanted to have more consistency in how those cases were investigated, because a lot of times the National Guard members may not be living, they may be at Camp Ripley, for example. They may not be in the city where they are living in. And so just having that consistency statewide was important. We've talked to the BCA. This has been a successful enactment of that law. And now the Sheriff's Association brought this bill before us to really expand on that and make sure that sexual assault cases are being investigated in a standardized and professional and impartial way for more members of the military. And so that's what this bill does, and I do have a testifier.
Great. Thank you so much. And to your testifier, you can state your name and title for the record and begin.
All right, thank you. The name is Sean Larson, and Chair Mueller, and to the committee, thanks for giving me this opportunity to speak. So Sean Larson, elected sheriff of Morrison County. I'm here to represent the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, as well as the other 87 sheriffs throughout the state of Minnesota. So in preparation for this legislation, we've talked to different stakeholders and those representatives to include the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, as well as Department of Military Affairs, and as well as the Minnesota National Guard. And it's important to point out that all parties involved have expressed support for this bill. So a little bit about Camp Ripley. It's a 53,000-acre regional facility that supports training requirements for both civilian and law enforcement agencies located located in Morrison County. So it is the largest military base in the state of Minnesota. Not only does Camp Ripley serve Minnesota National Guard members, they also served armed forces from across the country to include all branches of the military. So House File 1042 DE1 expands the investigative responsibilities of the BCA to include criminal sexual conduct cases involving all U.S. Armed Force service members, whether they are the victim or the accused, and the incident occurs on a state-owned military property. As it stands now, the BCA gets involved on military installations like Camp Ripley if the investigation of the criminal sexual conduct involves a member of the Minnesota National Guard, whom is the victim, and the accused is also a member of the Minnesota National Guard. So again, we're looking to expand that language to include the BCA to investigate criminal sexual conduct cases of all U.S. Armed Forces, whether they are the victim and or the accused, and the incident occurs on state-owned military property throughout the state. This would be an essential step to ensure consistency, impartiality, and the highest investigative standards in these sensitive cases. Just a little case scenario that happened in Morrison County back in July of 2024. We were informed by the BCA that they were advised that there was a criminal sexual conduct case that occurred at Camp Ripley. However, they said it didn't meet their criteria because of the language in the statute. That being, it was two Iowa Guard members, so therefore it got pushed back on our sheriff's office to investigate. So that's one of the scenarios I wanted to basically alert and talk about. So in conclusion, this bill ensures that no matter where a military member is from or where their unit is based, if an incident occurs on state military property, it will be handled by the BCA, who has statewide resources that allow them to better handle these type of cases. With that, I'd like to thank everybody for their dedication to public safety and for allowing me to speak.
Thank you so much, Sheriff Larson. We did not have anyone from the public signed up to testify on this bill, so we will move to member discussion. Any members have any? Oh, sorry, we did have a member. Co-Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist. Question for you. I think this makes a lot of sense, but I'm a little confused. Up in line on the DE 0.19, it says incident occurred in Minnesota, and then when you go down to 1.13, it's owned or controlled by the state for military purposes. I think it's missing a word that identify Minnesota, because I was trying to think, are we sending our BCAs out of the state to different places? You explained it, but I think we just got a little typo.
Co-Chair Mueller?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Witte. So per the BCA, we asked this question of them, and they don't have jurisdiction to investigate non-Minnesota cases. So the stakeholders didn't feel like it was necessary to add any additional language to this. That question had been asked.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Witte, no follow-up? Great, thanks. Any other member discussion? Representative or Chair Novotny.
Vice Chair Feist, we supported this bill and the concept, and I really appreciate the cleanup of language and the dialing in to make it better and fit the purpose that we need to do. Vital group, it's an investigative unit that's doing very specialized and sometimes intricate investigations based on rank and positions and authority and secrecy. So We endorse this, and I recommend a yes vote.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Chair Mueller?
It's a good bill, and I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. So Chair Mueller renews the motion that House File 1042, as amended, be re-referred to the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. All right, the next bill on the calendar is House File 1163. It's a Chair Joaquin bill. And I think, oh, there she is. Welcome to the committee. And since you are not a member of the committee, I will move to recommend that House File 1163 be placed on the general register. I don't see any amendments. So please go ahead and present your bill when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for pushing me around on the agenda. I've got stuck in ed policy. So good afternoon, Chair Mueller, Chair Novotny, and committee members. Thank you for hearing House File 1164, a bill that would make a few clarifications to the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program that is administered by Minnesota Firefighters Initiative. This is a program that has been funded by the legislature to aid firefighters across the state with training around cardiac care, by providing access to free mental health supports and monetary support for our firefighters who have been diagnosed with cancer or heart disease. This bill contains clarifying language from the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. No new funding is being requested. The bill adds peer-to-peer support language on lines 1.14. MnFIRE has been providing peer-to-peer support all along as part of HAAP, as it augments the emotional wellness services provided for our firefighters. There was a question about whether the current language included peer-to-peer support, so we wanted to add it to make it absolutely clear. And then on lines 1.18, the language changes from annually provide to annually make available the training that MnFIRE provides around critical illness. And my testifier can explain a little bit more about that. But while MnFIRE has trained about 82% of the departments across the state, some departments may decline, and this language reflects that. So members, there's some handouts in your packets that provide more information regarding the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program, as well as information about MnFIRE. I have one testifier here to briefly explain the reason for the changes and answer any questions that you may have.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rebecca Otto, the Minnesota Firefighter Initiative, or MnFIRE, and members, so happy to be here today. Thank you for hearing this really important bill. I call it the feel-good bill of the session. because it's so important for our fire service, it's making sure that we're supporting their physical and emotional health. And as many of you probably know, firefighters do incur emotional injury in their work. They experience a lot of trauma. So this bill is simply adding that peer support component, which law enforcement folks get as well. It's part of what's accepted in public safety, and it augments the mental health services that we provide to firefighters at no cost statewide. You can see that there's a statewide map we provided to you to see that, you know, the services we provided within the different counties statewide. Every county has departments in every county have participated in at least one program. Some have used all four. We hear from firefighters on a daily basis how important these programs are and that it's saved their lives and or saved their homes. As State Representative Joaquim stated, this bill's cleanup language, no new money requested, and I am happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. And we did not have anybody else sign up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing anybody, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Chair Joaquin, for bringing this bill. A lot of folks know I'm a firefighter up in Duluth there and did a lot of lobbying to get this bill passed over the years, and when it finally got across the finish line, a lot of folks are really excited. And a lot of times when legislation gets passed, it sometimes misses the mark, and this absolutely was not one of those things. Whether you're a full-time firefighter in Duluth or a volunteer firefighter in Worthington or wherever across the state, people are using this and taking advantage of it. We have a number of members who have used all the various different components of this, from the peer-to-peer training. It helped get our peer-to-peer support group off the ground, to the critical illness thing. My older brother is a firefighter, was diagnosed with job-related cancer and was able to use that funding to help get him through. So this is a good program that has worked exceptionally well, and just kudos to you and thank you for the cleanup language and making sure that it continues to work as it's intended.
Representative Rapinski.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill. As you know, I'm a former firefighter, both a volunteer and on a paid department. And as a former firefighter, I've actually never heard of this. And so I have a couple of questions. How new is this, or how long has this been in existence? And how many firefighters take advantage of this in a year?
Executive,
this is something, as I'm sorry.
I thought you were done.
As a former firefighter, I would love to go back to the number of rural departments that is in my district and inform them of this, and the paid departments that are in my district and inform them of this. And again, this is something I was not familiar with ever when in my term as a firefighter. So I have a few other questions for you, but let's start there. Thank you.
It's a great question. Executive Director Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member. That's good to hear, but so what we do is annually we mail out, this started in August 1 of 2021, that's when it was passed, so it's fairly new. It took a little time to get it off the ground because we have an insurance component, but all this is no cost to firefighters. Every year we mail benefit booklets to the fire departments. Your chief gets those booklets. They're should be dispensing them to all members of your department. And this covers all firefighters, whether you're paid on call, you know, career, it's everybody, all active, and it's structure fires. And so critical illness, if someone gets diagnosed as an active firefighter with cancer, cardiac disease, or PTSI, they can get claims paid to them to help support their health journey. So I'm happy to talk to you and get you information, and or we can talk to your departments. We can come down and do it like a fire district meeting if that would be helpful, and we would love your help. So we get the materials to the chiefs. We are at all the fire service conferences, and we go to district meetings to make sure that everyone knows of the resource. We're actually doing billboards right now in some of the parts of the state that haven't taken advantage of training. So again, we're trying to get to all departments. And there's quite a few departments that use it. So how many? I have numbers for you. There's some numbers on a flyer that you have for last calendar year in terms of we've paid out over $4 million in critical illness claims since the beginning of the program. And we've trained 82% of the departments since the beginning of the training. Well, last year we had 129 peer support calls. We had 1,205 mental health provider visits and 1,193 firefighter-focused mental health providers available. So we have a really large network of mental health providers for our fire service who can provide trauma-informed care. So I'm happy to give you my card, and I would love to have a conversation to see how else we can help your area.
Okay. I do have
none. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifiers. So when I was a firefighter, there was it was difficult sometimes to get reimbursed, if you will. So does this program offer reimbursements? I know when I was on a volunteer department, we would sometimes pay it out of our own pocket to go to different classes and go to educational facilities, and then in hopes to get reimbursed. And then other times, if we would put in for it, so to speak, we would be allowed, it would get funded, and it would kind of come through the chief and stuff like that. So how does this program work in looking at reimbursement and stuff? Is that something that happens for this also?
Executive Director Otto.
Madam Chair and members, great question. It's no cost. We will do these trainings for free. We have six trainings. We have a MinFire Aware class, which is like the 30,000-foot view. And then we have deep dives in cardiac, cancer, sleep, nutrition, emotional wellness. We're really pushing emotional wellness right now because we've seen a lot of claims increase around PTSI. So But yeah, there's no cost. So you're talking about the MBFTE reimbursements probably. Because the state funds us, we provide these at no cost. We send trainers to the departments. They've been trained to train. So that's the beauty of this thing. It's a low bar, and it's really a great resource for firefighters, as Representative Johnson testified as a firefighter. Thank you.
Anything else?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank
All right. you. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And such a vital program. Chair, Representative Joaquin, thank you for bringing this forward, because it is important to get that help to these vital public servants right away. As we're sitting here and reading, I was reading through your packet, and I remember a member of our church had become a member of one of the local fire departments, and his very first call, because I talked to him at church before he got there, and the very first call that he went on was a car fire involving a death of a child. And I remember seeing the look on his face, and he didn't make it past that. Dropped out of the service, didn't get the help. So we need to have this available. They need to know about it. They need to get that help right away. I know the long-term effects that has had on him. So that happens hundreds or thousands of times throughout the state. So let's get these people that are willing to put their life on the line for us the help that they need. Thank you.
Any closing comment, Chair Joaquin?
Thank you, members. Thank you for the questions. And I know you're on a tight time schedule. I could go on for hours about how long it took to pass this bill when it shouldn't have and how important it is. And it's very few areas where we get to see the results of the work that we do up here. And this is a big part of it. So thank you. This is just a clarifying question. I look forward to having it included in whatever bill you put together and would love your support.
Thank you, Chair Joaquin. I renew the motion to recommend that House File 1163 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, members, based on the clock, we are going to move a couple things around here to make sure that bills that need further committee stops will be heard. And we're going to move next to House File 1775. It's Representative Pinto's bill. Chair Pinto, would you like to move to re-refer House File 1775 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, and I see that you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to explain that amendment and move that amendment,
please? Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to understand the bill, it relates to the reporting of information regarding pretrial detention is sort of the focus, and the bill is introduced, included a public dashboard that would be, among other things, would be quite expensive. And so the amendment both eliminates that, but also makes it clear that we're just talking about information that is already being collected and would require the reporting of that information statewide, as opposed to requiring any additional collecting of information by courts and others. We're not sort of adding to the burden of collecting information. So that's what the A1 is about, and I'd ask member support.
All right, Chair Pinto moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion to that amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. All right, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I briefly summarized it. This is information, you'll see it's quite a lengthy list, but it's information that's already being collected. It would be reported to the BCA and passed along the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, with the purpose being to have us have a better understanding of a system that is both really important and is also really opaque, which is our system of pretrial justice. So kind of what happens when somebody has been charged with a crime and is still awaiting trial. And there was a report that was commissioned by us 2 years ago asking that there be the system be examined. And one of the things that came out of that is simply that we just don't have a really clear picture of what's going on. I think whatever place we are in the ideological spectrum, it's helpful for us to have solid information that we can point to so we understand in a given county or given a charge, whatever it is, what's going on with the pretrial system. I think I've just got one testifier, Madam Chair, who can tell a little bit more about it, and then very happy to discuss it with the committee.
All right, thank you. We do have somebody remote as well. Yep. And then we have Anna Hall, who I believe is here today, if you want to come on up. And why don't you begin by telling us your name, and then you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Chair Novotny, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Hall. I am a criminal defense attorney at the Legal Rights Center, and I lead the Minnesota Justice Research Center's pretrial best practices project. In 2023, the legislature asked the MNJRC to take a look at Minnesota's pretrial practices, to study best practices around the country and to make recommendations for policy change. Our preliminary report was submitted to this committee on February 15th of last year, and that report recommended that the legislature create a statewide pretrial data system, which is what House File 1775 would do. Members, without a standard system of data collection, Minnesota's pretrial system lacks transparency, which makes it extremely difficult for Minnesotans to understand and evaluate basic aspects of the pretrial system. Questions like, how often do people fail to appear for court hearings in Minnesota? Are people held pretrial in Minnesota more likely to plead guilty than those who are released during the pretrial period? Do people who post cash bail violate conditions of release at higher rates? These are all questions that we cannot currently answer in Minnesota. And that is because we lack statewide data. House File 1775 would increase the transparency of Minnesota's criminal legal system and increase public confidence in the fairness of that system. System actors at every level would be able to use the data produced under House File 1775 to study and improve local and statewide practices. Minnesotans deserve to know whether the policies that affect their lives are consistent with commonly held values like safety and equity, but as it stands, the system in Minnesota makes it very difficult to determine whether our pretrial policies live up to those values. A transparent data infrastructure that would be created under House File 1775 would move us closer to a system that upholds those values, would move us closer to equipping and empowering us to fix what isn't working in Minnesota and also uplift what is working, what is a model for the rest of the country. So I urge you to adopt the recommendations of the MNJRC in House File 1775. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And as we get ready for the next testifier, Travis Fisher, who I believe is remote, please turn your camera on and unmute yourself. And while that's happening, I'll just say that the report that was just mentioned that they did, that the Minnesota Justice Research Center did, is quite thorough. It is a very good report. All members of the committee should have a copy of that report. I assume it's available online somewhere as well. I'm seeing heads nod. I forgot to check in advance. but it really does a deep dive, and they did a ton of research into this topic. So I want to recommend that members and other members of the public take a look at that. I am not seeing if Travis is here. Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep, there you are. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Travis Fisher. I'm a probation officer with Cass County, and for the past 10 years, I've served as a pretrial probation officer. So I meet with individuals in our jail that are arrested under the crime of violence statute. I've completed a report for the court that advises them what is the likelihood that this individual is going to cooperate with their release conditions and follow through. And that is when I started in 2015, our jail was full. We had an 80 bed capacity and we were operating about 84. I have since halved that. We no longer rely as heavily on bail, and we rely on pretrial services because we know that money is a poor motivator to get people back to court. We also know that individuals our pretrial practices across the state are widely different. I think the best I can do is to share a story of a young female that I worked with who was charged with domestic assault and felony flee in a law enforcement in a motor vehicle. She had posted bail, but prior to coming to me, she was arrested in St. Louis County for an aggravated assault where she had discharged a firearm and shot someone several times. In St. Louis County, the court had only received a report that set bail at $200,000 unconditional only because their report said there's no condition that will ensure this person will follow through with any pretrial conditional release. What is a release in our county in Cass is probably a bailable offense in Hubbard or Beltrami or Itasca. So there's really no uniformity. And it's a challenge for us to really understand what is working and what doesn't without this research. That's why I believe it's important and the reason I'm here today supporting it. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. We did not have any other members of the public sign up to testify, but is there anybody here who wishes to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing anybody, so we can move to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto. You've done a great job of tilling the soil and having side conversations about this bill, and I very much appreciate that. With your author's amendment, as you disclosed to me yesterday, you got rid of subdivision 4 in the original bill, which would have provided that public dashboard that would have made the data available to public and researchers, interested parties. And you sold it to me the right way. It saves money, right? You know we like that. My concern is that because, at least as I read it, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, because the public will no longer have direct access to this data with that subdivision removed, we're really going to be seeing this data through a lens, and that lens seems to be established in 414 through 418 with the BCA contracting with a nonprofit research-based organization to summarize and analyze the information. And as we all know, whether intentional or not, analysis can sometimes come with a bias. And so I'd like you to speak to that. Is there any benefit in trying to find, maybe the dashboard isn't the way to do it, but some way for there to be broader public access to the data?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. Yeah, I mean, I think, so we certainly want as much access to be able to draw conclusions we can to the data. That's why the dashboard was in there in the first place. It was a several million dollar cost, which is per the conversation you and I had earlier. I guess I'll note that, you know, the really big lift here is having information in one place, right? The problem right now is answering any of the questions Ms. Hall said or any question, I mean, I've been thinking about my own experience when I'm on my other job in court, kind of figuring out like, well, you know, what do we do? How do we work things? Well, there's the data right now is scattered in probably literally a million places all around the state. So once it's all gathered in one place, I see your point about 414 to 418, there's this report. But I'll also note that nothing stops, whether it's the legislature or anybody else, in saying once it's gathered together, we want to know this thing. You know, hey, BCA and the Guidelines Commission, now that you've got that data in one place, we want you to tell us about this, look at this. Have a researcher look at it, whatever it is, right? So it's the big lift is getting in one place. Once it's in one place, there's all sorts of things that can happen with it. And so to my mind, that's there's nothing that stops later analysis and gathering of that data at all. Just for now, the thing that we'll know will happen is this report, but we can, you know, dive on in as well once the data is in one place.
Representative Hudson? All right. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So one of the questions I have, why does your author's amendment delete lines 13 and 14? We're no longer going to be collecting age of arrest data or primary language data. Is there any reason for that?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Representative Engen. I'm trying to remember exactly what the thinking is. So hold on a second. So you said it's, I think the thinking is that, so age at arrest, I believe, is covered under 112, right? Because you've got the year of birth, you've got the information about when the person was arrested, yeah, booking date, right? So age at arrest is kind of duplicative. I think we're just trying to make things be, to simplify things, if that makes sense. I'm trying to recall the exact conversation, but that's something that's sort of easy to calculate separately. And then primary language, I don't know there was a particular reason. We're just basically trying to keep as focused as possible the information that is gathered to reduce the burden on the reporting. And I guess the question is sort of what are we trying to figure out at each stage? So, I mean, I could imagine that there might be an argument for, you know, there might be something related to pretrial detention relating to language, but really it's just the iterative process of kind of getting focused on the questions we're trying to answer.
Representative Ingen.
No further questions. Thanks.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hollins was on the list. We'll let you close. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this forward. I think when I look at this, I'm really appreciative because, as you know, when we do the work that we're doing in the legislature, we like to have a lot of information behind it. We want to be doing things based on data and doing things correctly. And right now, I feel like we're flying blind. We're making guesses and we're making assumptions about what's happening and then trying to create laws that impact an entire state without having actual information behind it. And so I'm really hopeful that getting this moving forward will allow us to bring information here where we can really craft legislation that gets at the things that we think are happening or maybe new things that we have no idea about. So I really appreciate this. And like as a weird tangent, when I was an intern in law school in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, I had to do this project to get all of this data for all, I think it was like petty misdemeanors. Holy smokes, that's not the word I was gonna use. Holy smokes, that was really, really difficult and had to painstakingly go through it every single arrest by hand, citation by hand, making notes about all of it. And it was because we were trying to do some advocacy based on data. And we didn't wanna go in there and just say like, they're doing X, Y, and Z because we had no idea about it. So I really appreciate this. I wish somebody had done that in Illinois, frankly, because then I wouldn't have had to go through it by hand. So thank you.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Pinto, I've got a question before I go to comments. Do you actually have a fiscal note on what this bill would have cost before your amendment? And I ask that because you said you eliminated the publicly searchable database because of how much it would cost. So what would it have cost?
Chair Pinto.
And Madam Chair, and I don't believe we got a formal fiscal note. What I had understood the figure to be was several million dollars. But Chair Novotny, I will say that that's not based on, that's just my understanding. I think in conversations, I forget exactly where that came from. But I do know it would be a quite extensive project for the BCA. But no, I don't think a formal fiscal note was received, Mr. Chair.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And the rest will just be comment here coming up. I'm going to start off with this. Representative Hollins, for the first time in this session, I'm going to say you're right.
First, not the last.
This session. I've said it before. You're right. We are flying blind. This theory, this series of things that we would like to get information on, you may have seen something like this recently on a bill that I presented. Almost all this information is the same information that I've been asking for years because we are flying blind. The rest of the state is flying blind right now. And the way this bill was originally presented, not the amendment, what was originally presented by Representative Chair Pinto, I would have backed it, and I would have encouraged everyone to vote for this because this is what we believe the public needs to know. The amendment does several things. It eliminates the publicly searchable database, which then makes me say, why are we doing this anyway? Because it's still going to be select people having information that they can get selectively. None of the information that I can see that is asked to be gathered by either the original bill or the amendment is new information. but it's restricted in who can get it and who can see it. And if you know the right access, if you know where to go, if you're good with the kiosk at a courthouse, you might be able to get some of this information. But when we're all said and done, we have an undisclosed amount of money. We don't know what this bill is going to cost. So, Chair Moeller, can I have your commitment that this will come back to us before it goes anywhere?
It will.
Okay. So we don't know what even this is going to cost with what you've taken out. We don't know what it would have cost. As you know, I had proposed this several years ago, as I said, and the number that I was guessed, spitballed by someone, was nowhere near what you're saying. Okay. As far as the $2 million. But when it's all said and done, the idea was that we're going to do a bond study and see if it works, but your amendment takes out line 3.7 that says whether the defendant was charged with a new crime during the pretrial period, including the level of charge and statute charged. How are we going to know if bonding works or doesn't work if we take out the gathering of information to find out if it works? The one thing that we're supposed to be studying and coming up with an idea, your amendment took out. We have several lines that talk about a community nonprofit and individual community members with experts in data systems and pretrial policies will be involved in this. And then there's an unlisted grant amount, how much they will get for that. I'd like to point out, just for transparency, Minnesota Justice Research Center that was mentioned in this has already received $500,000 in a named grant to do this already. I suspect that they'd probably be involved, or they're what they believe, or, you know, they'll probably be the nonprofit research-based organization doing this. Maybe they won't, but we already spent $500,000 to get this information, and now we're going to give them more money. We don't have money to do the publicly searchable database so that everyone can see, and to Representative Hollins, that maybe we'll take the blinders off so that everybody can see. We don't have money for that, but we've got money to give other groups to do more research, where if we had a publicly searchable database, anyone could do the research and they could see what was going on themselves. As stated in the previous bill, we need to get this thing moving because of the dates that are coming up for hearings. So we'll move it out of judiciary, but I hope we can address some of these things and that there can be some meeting of somewhere in the middle. As you know, this isn't all the information that I've been requesting for a long time. We took out a lot of the judicial things and prosecutor oversight, but if we could meet somewhere, that'd be great. But otherwise, we're just spending more money so that one group can do research that we've already paid them for. So with that, Chair, I will recommend a vote so we can go to judiciary, but we'll see it when it comes back and we have the final fiscal note.
Thank you. So we'll let Chair Pinto respond to that and do the closing comments at the same time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Novotny. And yeah, very happy to continue conversations. I mean, I guess what we'll just note is the situation we're in right now, right, is that there's really valuable information that it would be of value for us to make important decisions, that is fragmented all over the state. We're balancing a number of different things here. I'm hearing both from members, maybe on your side of the aisle and others as well, concerns among like small county attorney's offices saying, well, wait a second, what am I having to collect? How am I reporting? I think part of the reason we took out those lines 3.7 to 3.8 is that the courts were saying we don't have that information and we're trying to focus this on information available to the courts. So I think this is an ongoing conversation. I mean, the bill was introduced with that dashboard, and we want to have as much information as we can. We're trying to balance out a lot in terms of budgets and various things. So I appreciate moving the bill to the next committee stop. It's going to come back to this committee, and we'll understand costs. But what I would say is that sort of whatever information we can collect and have be available and have reports done, that's going to be information that's going to help move us along. I'll just say I'm grateful to the Justice Research Center for the work that they've done in getting us to this point. We got valuable information, and part of what they identified, part of what came out of that is the need to be able to gather this kind of data. And so let's take advantage of it and actually start gathering it. I appreciate the committee's support to keep this conversation moving. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thanks, members, for the discussion. Chair Pinto renews the motion that House File 1775, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, members, next we will move to House File 1295. That is a Representative Johnson bill. All right, and Representative Johnson, would you like to move that House File 1295 be recommended to be placed on the General Register?
Yes, Chair, I would.
All right, and we will, hold on one second. Okay, we're going to wait on the amendment until after testimony. So, Representative Johnson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members. House File 1295 adds the 15 child advocacy centers to the list of victim assistance programs that would be eligible to receive a portion of the court imposed fines. Currently, 70% of the mandated fines are forwarded to these victim assistance programs and provide services in the county where the crime was committed. Additionally, these proceeds must be used to provide direct services to crime victims. Again, this bill simply adds the child advocacy centers to be the eligible list of agencies. And I do have two testifiers.
All right, great. And if both testifiers can come on up to the testifier table, we have Marsha Milliken and Christy Shannon, and I don't know who wants to go first, so you get to choose. And when you start, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Chair Mueller, while they're being seated, is this Representative Johnson's first time testifying?
No.
In this committee? I'm not sure.
In this committee, yeah.
It is, but yeah. All right. all right, go ahead.
Hi there. Good afternoon, Chair Mueller and committee members. My name is Christy Shannon. I'm Executive Director of Corner House Children's Advocacy Center in Minneapolis. This statute, 609.101 subdivision 2, is important for victim services in Minnesota. Not only for the revenue it provides agencies that serve victims of crimes such as domestic violence and sexual assault, but the fact that there is justice in having fines paid by perpetrators who committed such crimes go back to support others who have also experienced that type of victimization. What is missing from the statute currently, though, as has been mentioned, is the inclusion of children's advocacy centers, which serve victims of child abuse, and especially since some of the crimes related to this statute do reference crimes against minors. We regularly, as victims or children's advocacy centers, we regularly partner with domestic violence and sexual assault programs, but our services and those of the other children's advocacy centers across the state are also distinct in that they're tailored to victims under the age of 18. And a prior testifier talked a bit about children's advocacy centers and the type of services we have, but to expand on that a bit, we have forensic interviewing, and that is specifically child-centered and age-appropriate and delivered by trained interviewers who work daily in partnership with law enforcement and child welfare. We have court advocacy services that walk beside children and caregivers as they navigate the criminal justice process. And we also have family advocacy that involves caregivers and in their children's healing process. We also have trauma-focused therapy specifically for victims of child abuse that include play therapy that is age-appropriate for young survivors. So I ask for your support for HF 1295 to include children's advocacy centers alongside our other victim service partners in the statute.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome back to the committee. Marsha Milliken, please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and committee members. My name is Marsha Milliken. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance, and we're a coalition of children's advocacy centers and multidisciplinary teams who coordinate the investigation, prosecution, and treatment for kids who've been abused. I'm here to encourage you to support HF 1295. It is a way for child advocacy centers to have a little more revenue without going to the general fund. And so I'll just be brief because they've said everything. The fact that 70% of these funds do go to victim service programs, and the fact that child advocacy centers at the time were not included, I encourage you to include them in the list of providers.
Thanks. Thank you for your testimony. We didn't have anybody else from the public sign up to testify. Is there anyone? All right, not seeing anyone, we will move on to member questions. Well, oh, and we do have, let's do member questions, and then we'll do the A1 amendment. Any member questions or discussions? Representative Hollins.
I mean, I think this is a really good bill, and I think it was Chair Novotny who took away my harassing of you. I just wanted Representative Steer to know that it's a bipartisan effort, that I think everybody should have to bring treats. So... I don't know who said it. My back is turned to everybody, so I don't know who said it. But somebody said it, so I'm sad. But otherwise, I think this is a really good bill. Thank you.
All right. Representative Novotny, did you want to offer an amendment first, or do you have comments, or someone else has an amendment?
I do not know what she's talking about.
All right. Oh, Representative Harder, A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members. So the amendment that you see before you just updates the statutory terminology from the 2023 Public Safety Omnibus Bill.
All right, so let's see. Representative Harder has moved the A1 amendment. Representative Johnson to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Harder, for catching that and making the updated language. I encourage support.
All right, yes, it is good to update language when we have that opportunity. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. All right, Chair Novotny.
Vote yes.
We heard you. I think you said vote yes. It's hard to hear.
Vote yes.
Okay, vote yes. Any closing comments, Representative Johnson?
No, Chair, it speaks for itself. It's a great program. They do amazing work across the state and encourage support.
All right, with that, Representative Johnson renews the motion to recommend that House File 1295 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, Representative Johnson can stay there. Thanks again to the testifiers. Up next is House File 1686. We will be moving to lay over House File 1686. And your bill is before us. I believe you have two amendments. And so let's start with the A1 amendment. Is there anything you wish to say about the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Chair. The A1 amendment is based on a lot of feedback that we've gotten so far. It clarifies that part-time event staff will be exempted from the proposed expanded training requirements. Often these events have medical and law enforcement on site as well. So this was clarifying to make sure that we're getting training to the right people.
Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Chair Novotny.
Representative Mueller, Chair Mueller, Representative Johnson, is there any clarification that's going to be on what is a part-time basis?
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mueller, Chair Novotny, we are working on clarifying that. I did not have that clarified when I put it in. Same thing with clarifying exactly what event staff is. And so this bill is going to continue to be worked on.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
All right, seeing no further discussion on the A1 amendment, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now to the A2 amendment. Representative Johnson, do you want to explain the A2?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. The A2 amendment delays the 40-hour training requirement that is outlined in the A1 amendment until August 1st of 2026. Again, this was based on feedback to give us more time to figure out the logistics and some of the training options, extending out 16 months. It also clarifies that employees hired before that date will not have to meet that requirement.
All right, so I just found out that this amendment is amending the other one, so we did things a little bit out of order. Mr. Deville, do you want to explain what we need to do to correct the record here?
Madam Chair and members, just need to reconsider the vote on the A1 and have that before the body, and then consider the amendment to the amendment to put the A1 into the form that the author would like.
All right. So I will move that we reconsider adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. So the A1 amendment is back before us. And now you, Representative Johnson, are moving the A2 amendment to amend the A1. Did I say that correctly?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And you already explained your A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Now we will move the A1 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. All right, this is a lot for the first day back with the gavel here. All right, so the bill I think is now amended as you want it to be amended. If you can please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you for the opportunity to present this important piece of legislation that seeks to enhance the training requirements for security officers across our state. Security officers often serve on the front lines of public safety, playing an essential role in protecting our buildings, businesses, and communities. As it stands, many security officers enter the profession with minimal training, only 12 hours in some cases, before assuming roles that require them, often while working alone, to de-escalate tense situations, interact with vulnerable populations, and at times place themselves in harm's way. The gap in training has led to some unfortunate incidents, including assaults on officers and situations escalating beyond control due to lack of preparedness. The reality is that proper, comprehensive, and in-person training is a necessity. In the fire service, we often talk about a training culture where our members crave quality, relevant training. We talk about building muscle memory so that when we are faced with critical situations, we don't freeze up or vapor lock, and this requires significant training to develop that. We also train to ensure that we're able to provide the highest level of care for all the people that we encounter in our day-to-day. This bill hopes to help foster that same training culture for security officers by increasing the initial training requirements from 12 to 40 hours and expanding the ongoing annual training from 6 to 24 hours. Enhanced training will cover things like community health, mental health first aid, Narcan administration, nonviolent de-escalation techniques, security industry orientation, and public safety management. These changes will ensure security officers are better equipped to handle those emergencies, protect public safety, and collaborate with law enforcement and other first responders. Ideally, there's a lot of other options besides calling 911 in a lot of these situations, which also frees up other resources. The amendments were based on feedback that has been received so far, and we'll continue to get feedback and adjust as needed. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm happy to answer questions after testifiers.
All right, thank you. And I believe you have three testifiers, and then we had a couple of others sign up. So if your three testifiers can come to the table, we have Jerry Pulley, Deb Sievers, and Greg Cook. And as with the last bill, I don't know what order you all want to go in. So as long as you introduce yourself and begin your testimony, it does not matter to us who goes first. And I'll just let members know, too, we have been given some permission to go over time, but as testifiers, please try to keep your testimony to the time limits that were given in advance, just because we're running close on time here. So whoever wants to begin, welcome. Please begin.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry, and members of the committee, I'm here today to strongly support the bill requiring the increase in security officer training from 12 hours to 40 hours because of the uncertainty of the environment the security officer may be assigned. Security officers, as already been reiterated, serve as the first line of defense, and at one point in time during the pandemic has been designated as an essential employee. That designation has not been removed. It is not being used, but it has not been removed from the security officer's bay. By increasing the hours of training to 40 hours, we can ensure security officers receive proper instructions in de-escalation techniques, emergency response, legal limitations, and situational awareness. Yet in other current regulations, security officers in our state receive only 6 hours of training before they are entrusted with the huge responsibility of making sure that there is a safety factor with the employers as well as with the employees. Other states have already recognized the need for enhanced training. Studies show that better trained security personnel lead to reduced incidents, improved public safety, and fewer liabilities for employees. A minimum investment in training today can prevent costly mistakes, lawsuits, and tragedies in the future. I urge you to support this bill to professionalize the security industry to enhance public safety and give safety officers the tools they need to do their jobs effectively. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Deb Severs, and I have been a security officer for 6 years. I am a member of SEIU Local 26, and I am here today in support of HF 1686 to increase training for security officers of Minnesota. Over many different security jobs I have done over the years, I have enjoyed meeting so many different people. I like seeing people smile at my sites because I know that means people feel safe being in our buildings. It feels good at the end of the day knowing I've done my job and no one got hurt. But the reality is that most security officers don't get enough training, and that makes us nervous. This bill would expand training for licensed security officers to 40 hours and ensure continuing education. I would love to know we are all trained on basic medical knowledge, de-escalation training, mental health crisis, and more. Right now, Minnesota only requires companies to provide 12 hours of bare bones training before security officers start at a site. I used to work as a bus driver for Metro Transit and got more training in that job around security issues and safety than I do as a security officer. How does that make sense? Sometimes we are the only staff in the building. We protect buildings worth millions of dollars and interact with so many people. And I think we deserve the tools to be better prepared. We're there to be the first line of defense in our community. If we don't have the tools to do our job, it is bad for all of us. I hope you care about this issue because our job is to keep you and everyone safe. You want reliable and trained people doing this work. It shouldn't be different levels of training from building to building, wondering if that person has the support they need. This bill ensuring more training would help me feel confident I'd be able to face the different situations we know come up. Training not only will make everyone more safe, but it will make this job more of a profession and keep good people doing this important work. Please vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And Greg Cook, Executive Director. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Just so you know, I was allowed 2 minutes, and I'm going to kind of yield 1 minute of mine to my board chair, Richard Hodson. So I'm just going to split mine in half here.
That is fine.
Again, good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Greg Cook, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. In regard to HF 1686, our agency, the board, and the industry are not opposed to enhanced training. It is the required hours and some of the language of the bill we're trying to wrap our heads around. I'm currently working on a fiscal note, and it's looking like we will at least be doubling our budget. These new courses would need to be extensively reviewed upon submission and be audited going forward. With the potential of increased violations, there will be some added resources needed. These increased requirements would create more incentive for unlicensed activity. One of the largest impacts would be the major administrative rule changes that could take place. It is highly likely that this could go into hundreds of thousands of dollars alone. As I state in my report to you, there is an option for consideration. Form a policy review working group made up of the stakeholders. Our agency could facilitate the process. This group could develop a very detailed content for required courses. We could develop a test to ensure the material is understood. Once developed, actually run the course through several different groups and see how long it actually takes. make a decision on how many hours should be required after it is determined the length of time needed. I'm yielding the rest of my time to our board chair, Richard Hodson.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, Richard Hodson, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. Today I am appearing as chair of the board that that operates and licenses the industry. I'm here only to speak to an administrative aspect of this proposal. Representative Novotny already addressed some of the logistical issues, for example, definitions of what is event security, what's part-time. The proposal would require this to be done by means of rulemaking as well as the course curriculum. We don't even know what the course curriculum is. This is a very lengthy process to go through the administrative law process. I know this because in my other life I have been an attorney involving, I've been with the, represented with the Post Board over the years. I've been involved with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association since 1986 in many of these very halls. You are talking of a process that would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in all likelihood. That's not a reason not against doing it, but I do think it has a significant fiscal note. And I do think that the timeline is completely unrealistic. This body in 2001 directed the Minnesota Department of Corrections under the under law to change its rules for jail operations. That was in 2001, and they are still, hopefully by 2026, going to have those rules finally into effect. So even with the representative's thoughtful delay of moving this out to middle of 2026, it just simply isn't realistic. And we ask you to take that into account on behalf of my agency.
All right, thanks for your testimony. We have two others who've signed up to testify. We have Kelly Johnson, I believe remote. If you can go ahead and unmute and begin your testimony. Please introduce yourself first, too.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Kelly Johnson, founder of Hard Target Security. We provide unarmed security services and training in the Bemidji area. I agree with my esteemed security partners throughout this state. This proposal is a poor solution in search of a non-existent problem. In fact, this proposal would do exactly the opposite of what I believe most of you desire, which is to provide better security services at an affordable rate for our citizens. Our occupation is already strictly regulated in this state by the gentleman you just heard from. If this becomes law, a large number of legitimate security companies will go out of business. And more importantly, we would then have to compete against even more unregulated and unlicensed security activity already occurring across the state. If an organization or business wants better trained agents with EMR qualified agents and having the latest on every possible training required, then they have the option to hire off-duty police officers at a staggering rate of nearly $120 per hour. Most venues can't afford that and strictly need someone to respond to minor disturbances, lost children, minor injuries, and other calls for services and duties. We are not cops. We are not ambulance crews. Currently, our company puts in an average of $800 per employee prior to full-time employment, and now this bill would be asking us to double that. Security company like ours, nor the current market, can absorb these 200% increases in operating costs. I ask that you vote no to this proposal, not because it's a bad idea. We all want better trained protective agents, but this isn't the right answer. Thank you.
All right, thanks for your testimony. Next, we have Nick Rabineau. Go ahead. Yeah, please come up to the testifiers table and introduce yourself and begin your testimony. And then after that, we will move on to member discussion. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Nick Rabineau. I'm the president and owner of Integris Risk Solutions. We provide armed security and risk management all throughout Minnesota. I'm not here to say that the training aspect is a bad thing because we only hire military and law enforcement personnel for our security. But I do want to bring up a few things that has to do with the process of what's going on here. In my prior life, I was in the Green Berets in the Army, and I did 20 deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. And when it comes to training, that is what brought me home every single time. So I'm very big on the proponent side of the training aspect of this. I want to bring up a few things. I'm going to tell you two really quick stories. As law enforcement numbers have declined over the years and have had a hard time coming back up when it comes to the lengthy process of a training program and then the FTO program beyond that for an officer to actually hit the streets, it's very difficult for them to fill off-duty jobs. Now there's other rules and regulations that have stepped in that have caused them to not be able to support large events such as the Minnesota Vikings. So they've been very hamstrung on this. We are the only other option for law enforcement in our community. The two stories I'm going to tell, one is how we actually got the Minnesota Vikings contract. We had that contract. We picked that contract up simply because there was not enough law enforcement to support the games. And if a game through the NFL league does not have the required number of personnel for perimeter security, that game gets canceled on game day. I think that's really important to think about. The other thing is when the riots took place in March of 2020, I was involved in standing up a little over 100 contract personnel to come up and provide security, and one of our largest clients was Cub Food. When we did this, we had a 24-hour notice. Now, if you look around at all the Cub Foods, there was only one burnt down, and that was the one that burnt down before we come up to take over the security operations. If those Cub Foods, like at Uptown Cub, which is obviously downtown, if that Cub Food would have burned down on the first week, which is inevitable, what would have taken place with the community? You shut down public transit. We shut down all aspects of movement through the city other than if you owned a car. And instead of those grocery stores being utilized by the residents and those burnt down, we would be having home invasions because people have food in their house for 3 days, maybe four at the most. And the people that we're talking about, probably less. And so now what you're going to have.
All right, Mr. Rabineau, you've gone well over a minute the allotted time was. So do you just want to wrap it up, please?
Yeah, no problem. For my personal opinion, we as companies cannot afford to have this the union process put on us. And on top of it, we provide our own internal standards. And it makes me feel like the BCA isn't doing their job if a union is going to come in and essentially take that over, which I think the BCA has done a great job thus far. Thank you.
All right, we are going to move to member discussion. I'm just going to say something that's rather shocking to me, and that is that if I go to a Vikings game, that I don't have someone who feels like they're adequately trained as a security guard in light of how quickly they had to bring folks in, and also the issue with the riots, too. I want to make sure that people that are hired for these positions have enough training. And, you know, the SEIU member that testified talked about she had more training as a bus driver than she did as security officer, and that's very troubling to me. So I understand the bill's going to get laid over. There's a lot of more work that needs to be done on it, but I just wanted to make those points. Do we have some member discussion? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're way over time, so I'll try to be as concise as possible. The early portion of my adult life I spent in this industry, working in a variety of environments, hospitals, school campuses, industrial facilities, both as a rank and file officer, as a supervisor, as a manager. I've trained people. I've, of course, been trained throughout all of that. And because of being the kind of that middle management side, I understand a little bit of the business angle of it as well. And what you have in a lot of these situations is this tension that often exists between clients and contractors, where there's a contract in place. If you are contracted to provide a certain service, you must provide it. And in this particular industry, that requires having people who are ready to go, butts in seats. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that we should sacrifice the quality of the service in order to fulfill that contract, but I think that the tension there properly ought to be governed by the relationship between the client and the contractor and the price signals that are involved. We hear a lot about how much it would cost in order to do this for license holders. We had a great letter from one of our testifiers here, Mr. Cook, from the Minnesota Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services, stating that this could potentially double or more the agency's budget, so we're talking about a significant state cost. It's interesting to consider the percentage difference in these training requirements. Pre-assignment goes from 12 to 40.
That's a 333% increase. Again, that's for Mr. Cook. Annual goes from 6 to 24. That's a 400% increase. And the quote that kind of sums up the impact of that on license holders, on the people who actually provide these services, is one could ascertain that these percentages could be used to calculate the increase in training expenses to the license holder. And that was echoed in some of the written testimony that we have in our packets. Another quote from Mr. Cook's letter, we've seen statistics as high as 90 to 400% annual turnover rate in this industry. And that's certainly something, looking back upon my experience, that I can attest to. And it actually is an argument for one of the things that this bill would take away, which is the possibility of utilizing online training. I remember the first job I took, I was trained by a guy who did not want to train me. And in retrospect, I know the reason he didn't want to train me is because he trains all the time. And he feels like there's no point because I'm just going to end up leaving like everybody else. Online training takes out that kind of human component and says you're going to have a consistently developed training program that we have data to back up how it functions. And it doesn't entirely replace in-person training, but it provides a valuable supplement. So when we're talking about an industry where turnover is a huge problem, where you have situations which have been discussed that are emergent and urgent and need immediate services provided, I think while the spirit of what this bill is trying to accomplish is noble, this one-size-fits-all implementation is not going to function for this industry, and it's going to leave folks in this state who rely upon these services worse off in an unintentional way. Thank you.
And we just have a couple members on the list, so if you want to address that in your closing comments, we'll save it for then. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for this bill. I'm a strong proponent of having really good, solid training when it comes to anything public safety. I've used the sort of metaphor, not just in public safety, but in other areas too, where like we're not trying to send a mall cop to a heroin raid, right? Like we want to make sure we have people with the right training in the right spaces. And I certainly, as a former police officer myself, I fully understand and appreciate what training does, not only for the public, but to keep the person in that position safe as well. So I think, it's really crucial every time we talk about training for people who are charged with protecting others. We can't take it lightly, and I think that it's always worth the funding, and I don't think expense for private industries, I understand that it's an expense, but I think it's a worthwhile one considering the excellent service that they'd be able to continue to provide and provide even better service and better protect employees. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. I've been actually hearing about this issue for quite a few years now, and I think in the Labor Committee, we talk a lot about training, about, frankly, the benefit the training has for the public, but also for the workers. Just a quick question, and then I have a comment, but I didn't see anything in this bill that said, I heard from the last testifier, it was about the union. I just saw requirements on training. Can you just clarify, is this bill require that training be provided by a union, or can it be provided by anybody who'll provide that?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Representative Greenman. The training would be developed and implemented with the guidance of the board. They would set the standards and ultimately determine who delivers that training.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate that. I just wanted to get clarity. The thing I will say, and I heard the last testifier talk about contracted security, and I hope that those contracted security are actually independent contractors following the law and not misclassified workers. Because what I know in this industry, and we hear it in labor, it was in, if you've been watching any of the 14 months of testimony we've had in the misclassification task force with the AG, that private security is actually one of the areas where we have very high misclassification rates. And the reason that that impacts this issue is that what we do is outsource and put the work of both the training, put the work of the business onto the workers in this case. And so I hope that the folks that testified, I hope that they're doing their due diligence and they actually are not misclassifying their workers. But Also, I think we should ensure that people have the training and that there's consistent training no matter how and who they work for. So thank you for this bill.
And Chair Novotny.
Chair, is there a fiscal note?
I believe one has been requested.
All right. I'll be very brief. I don't think it's ready, Representative Johnson. There's a lot of things that need to be cleaned up, things that need to be very much specified. There's so many different levels of what security is. If you think about the different places just in the city of Minneapolis that have security, one could be sitting in a locked room with a camera watching TVs. One could be exposed as, you know, talking about the Vikings fans, or even worse, the Green Bay Packer fans. But it needs a lot of work. There's people here that have experience that have worked security. I ask you to reach out and do that before we come back to this bill.
Closing comments, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. Chair Novotny, absolutely look forward to having some of those conversations. I appreciate the feedback that's been received so far. It's highlighted, you know, some issues with training in general, but it's also highlighted other industries in the industry itself with non-licensed personnel coming in and filling some of these roles. And, you know, maybe part of this discussion is figuring out how to make sure the board has the resources to enforce those types of things as well. There have been some good suggestions that we have incorporated into the feedback and into the amendment so far. Some suggestions like allowing prior training to be counted for some of the training hours, pushing out the timeline, requiring knowledge checks to ensure information has been retained, taking a harder look at the hour requirements. There's also been some feedback that hasn't been entirely helpful, which includes comments that demean and devalue workers, like, why would anyone need 40 hours of training to sit and watch a vacant building? And various forms of these workers are not worth the investment, they just quit anyway. I've also had some folks reach out and suggest that because a labor union is supportive of this, somehow that makes it problematic. For generations, labor unions have fought for improved workplace safety and improved things like training. It's not just for their members, but it lifts up all workers in those industries. And I am heartened to see that a lot of the organizations or businesses that have reached out with concerns, when I look at their websites and learn a little bit more about the businesses and things that they operate, a lot of them do have that culture of training already, and say very clearly in their websites that they offer a very high level of training to the folks that they are putting out in those different situations. So hopefully it is not too much of a pivot to have some of these other things rolled into those training platforms. I appreciate the questions, the testimony, the feedback I've gotten so far. I understand this is a big change for the industry, absolutely. When you require changes like this, increased hours, things like that, but I just suggest that we not wait until something tragic happens so we don't have somebody to name this bill after. Legislation does not always have to be reactionary. Look at this as being something that is proactive and hopefully avoiding some of those things in the future. With this bill being laid over, my intention is to keep working on it and ensure that it delivers quality, comprehensive training to our security officers here in Minnesota and is in a workable form for the employers as well. And I welcome the continued conversations and leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thanks to all the testifiers today and to the members for helping keep things moving. My apologies, we went a little late, but appreciate everybody. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.